Well, thank you, Kenny. Kind of like being shot out of a cannon real quick, won't it? First of all, I'd like to thank the people involved for getting me here this weekend. Tom, Charles, and a lot of other people that I've known over the years. And I've been asked to come down here several times, and things just didn't work out, but I'm glad I'm here. I've been sitting around here since Friday. And I was wondering this morning if I was going to get a chance to say a few words. You know, you go to these events, and I'll tell it every time, so it reminds me of a story they told many years ago back in North Carolina. They had a state convention. They had one of these long-winded speakers, and he got to going. He talked about the first hour, he talked about the first 12 steps. Second hour, he got into 12 traditions. Third hour, he got into three legacies. And people began to leave, and they will leave. I found it out one night. And sure enough, everybody left but one man that kept sitting on the front row. And, of course, the speaker got concerned, wound up the talk, ran down from the podium, grabbed the man by the hand, said, "I want to ask you one question. Everybody left but you. Why'd you stay?" And he said, "Hell, I'm the next speaker." Well, you kind of know how I feel this morning, don't you? And, you know, I've heard it over the years, you know, the preface of Sunday morning deal, the fella come up and clean up the mess. And there's been no mess here this weekend. It's been a fine conference, and I really enjoyed being here and to be a part of it and seeing old friends and meeting new friends, I hope. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Dave Cook. Hi, everybody.
Hi, Dave.
I'm a member of the Big Book Group in Raleigh, North Carolina, which I've always said, like some of you, I think it's the best in the world. But by God's grace, and because this program works for me, and through the help of some understanding sponsors who have led me with a kind but firm hand, through the love of two wives, a woman that I met after I got sober, and they died a couple of years ago, and they helped me a lot in my sobriety. Some of you knew Sue, and then the wife I have today, Julie, who was a gift from God. Julie, stand up and let them see that I have the family. This is Julie, my wife. And it's through their helping people and alcoholics and anonymous like you that I've found that I can stay sober, and I've been sober. You know, every time I give my sobriety date, in some areas you offend people when you give sobriety dates. I know I used to hate the old timer when they got up and stand up and give. I resented the hell out of them, I'd be honest. And, you know, I thought they were showing off. And every time I give my sobriety date, I think about one of the old circuit riders. Some of you knew him, Burton Crawford from Kilgore, Texas. You know, in Texas, if you don't give your sobriety date, hell, they'll shoot you. And Burton would stand up and said, "My name's Burton Crawford." He was from Kilgore, Texas. Said, "My name's Burton Crawford, and I've been sober ever since I can remember." Well, when you think about it, that's about all of us. We've been sober since we can remember. But by God's grace, and because this program works for me, I haven't found necessary to take a drink or any tablets since the day I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is September 12, 1957. And for this, I'm very grateful. AA took me on September the 11th, but I had a sponsor that says, "You don't count your sobriety until you have one day." And so the 12th was my first day of sobriety. And I never want to forget it, because that old central group in Roanoke, Virginia, where I came into AA, they had a saying, if you remember that group and you got behind that podium and you didn't give your sobriety date, you usually didn't have one. And I can remember the first discussion meeting I ever went to in Alcoholics Anonymous. There was 13 or 14 wicker chairs sitting in a circle. And I was no different from anybody else that goes to our first discussion meeting. I began to wonder what I was going to say when it got to me. And it finally got to me. And the man who had become my first sponsor spoke up and told me what to say. He said, "Give your name and your sobriety date. That's all you're qualified to do." And that's the way I felt about it ever since. I've received a lot from this program. A lot of benefits. Modular benefits such as peace of mind, serenity, material things. But any time I think about marginal benefits, I have to talk about the basics. And the basic benefit that this alcoholic has received is my sanity. My sanity. And as a sane alcoholic now, I find I don't have to run anymore. I don't have to cheat or steal anymore. And, you know, I don't have to sober up anymore. And that was the name of the game. I didn't know it when I got here. I didn't have to sober up anymore. I look around this room and I see some people who've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm not an old timer. Now, the old timers were the people that were here before I got here, and the circuit riders is what we used to call them. And I learned much from them. And like Liz was talking last night, you know, I sometimes wish AA was like it was in 57. And I go to a lot of places, and a lot of things are happening in Alcoholics Anonymous in strange places. People in talking in unknown tongues in some meetings. Some people have the cure for everything in some AA meetings. And I don't know whether it's diluted AA or not, but all I know about Alcoholics Anonymous is what I learned from my sponsor and the big book and going to a lot of meetings. And it was basic AA. Now, I didn't take my first drink until I was 16 years of age. I knew what liquor could do to a grown man. I saw what happened to my father. My father was an alcoholic. I didn't know it until I got sober in AA. I didn't know anything about alcoholism until I got an Alcoholics Anonymous. Because of his drinking, it led to a divorce in my home when I was 12 years of age. And my mother was able to clothe and feed me and send me off and give me a good education. And I remember promising my mother when I was a kid, about 12, that I'd never be like him. I despised my father. I just didn't like him for what he was doing to my mother. And he was a drunk. He was a drunk, you know, one of those periodics. You've heard the expression, he was a good man as long as he didn't drink. He was a good man as long as he didn't drink. And he was a good man. And I wish my father could have found Alcoholics Anonymous because he'd have made a damn good member, I'll tell you that. Because he loved people. He loved to tell stories, and we love to tell stories, don't we? And I went off to school, and that's where I came in contact with booze the first time. It was old store-bought wine. I never forgot it. We got drunk on a resentment one night, a bunch of us fellas. Got sick as a dog. Started drinking a little and having a lot of trouble getting it down in the beginning. You know, we work at it. Throwing up and wanting, gagging exercises. And years ago, I heard one of the fellas that... See, when I went off to school, it was just after World War II was over. A fellow just come back from on the GI Bill. And I was around people a lot older now. And I've always said that, you know, if you're in an environment, you stay in it long enough, you'll adjust to that environment. In sobriety or drinking, you're going to be a part of it if you stay in it long enough. And I stayed in it long enough until I wanted to do what the big boys are doing. And like I said, I was having trouble getting it down, and one of the fellows, they talked about the pleasure that was in drinking, and I didn't understand what the hell they were talking about. And one night I asked one of them, "When does the pleasure come that you speak of?" And I never forgot what he told me. He said, "Dave," says, "if you remember, there's a little pause in between from the time you take the drink and when you throw up, that's the pleasure." And so you can begin to know what I'm talking about. Started doing strange things. I studied engineering, but when I finished college, I started coaching high school basketball because of my basketball ability. I don't know whether it's egotism or what, but... And I went off and I had success in coaching. And my drinking at that time just consisted of getting together with some classmates on weekends and having a party. Now, the parties got bigger and bigger and bigger. By that I mean, you know, when you teach school, you're supposed to be there on Monday morning. Well, I usually didn't get back to Monday afternoon sometimes. You know, begin to slip a little, you know what I mean. Getting loose. Not doing what I was supposed to do. And it finally got to the point that I moved upstairs in the coaching profession, two different schools, much larger high school, and where I had finally the opportunity to drink about every night because I was associating with school board members that drank. It gave me a place to go every night. And it went long before I began to get in trouble, although I didn't know it was trouble. People began to notice my drinking. School authorities. And I remember calling them in for the first time about my drinking, and I denied it and resented it. And you know how the drunk is. He gets people off his back. I decided I'd divert their attention, so I decided I'd get married. And I courted a girl for about 2 weeks, and we got married and carried two other couples with us on the honeymoon. And you can begin to see that a little alcoholism was something mixed up in this stuff. And I don't know. I look back now And like, you know, the alcoholic, as it says in Al-Anon, the alcoholic hurts so many people, destroys so many people. And this woman and I lived together for a year and a half because of the fact that the embarrassment would bring if I got a divorce or we got a divorce. And yet I'm the community drunk by now, and everybody knows it except she and I. And finally she had sense enough to leave, and finally they had sense enough to fire me from the job that I'd had for 5 years and been successful in. Prior to this, at one instant, my mother, now let me tell you about mother. I had a mama that loved me to death. And my mother did everything she knew to do for me growing up as a kid and when I got into heavy drinking and getting in trouble. And my mother loved me to death. She really did. And at one interval, one summer, I was having some problems. And you see, long then, there were no such thing as treatment centers. They had what they call drying out places. And I went to some of the best up and down the East Coast and drying out, you know, where you go taper off. I don't know if you ever tapered off. I enjoyed tapering off. You just sip and taper off. And I'd usually come back and wear a shape and when I went. And I did this 3 or 4 times, and finally I started back to school, and led to my downfall. I got into problem with some duties that I was supposed to perform, and I lost the job, and then I wound up. I kept moving. In the state of North Carolina, you keep moving east. That's what I did. I just kept moving east, and finally I wound up the rock bottom of schools. And it was a rock bottom, and I lasted for about 6.5 months. Got to the point that I was drinking every morning in order to stop shaking so I'd get my clothes on, get to school, and I was doing the same job, coaching ball. And then one morning, after 6.5 months at this particular school, the principal just stopped me in the hall and said, "We don't need you anymore." Now, I was going under the influence of booze the whole time, and getting drunk at night, and rural consolidated school, and I left school that day for the first time in my life. I look back now, and I really believe, by now, although I didn't know it, I'd crossed that invisible line that we speak of. I'd become an alcoholic, looking back. And to me, what an alcoholic is a man or woman take one drink and can no longer guarantee you their behavior. And that's what happened to me. I got to the point that I'd take one drink, and I couldn't guarantee you my behavior. I left school that day, and I woke up in jail 2 weeks later for the first time in my life. Didn't know where I was or what was going on. And a man began to talk to me through a cell door. And this man, I later found out, was a county health doctor. And he said, "Son," says, "we're going to send you to a place where they can cure you." Now, I didn't know what he was talking about, curing me. I know I hadn't eaten in a long time, and I began to envision, you know, I was going back to one of those places where I could taper off, sit on a lawn chair on some soft green grass under one of the umbrellas and sip. That's where I thought I was going. And I didn't go there. The state insane asylum in my home state is called Dix Hill. I, too, found my thrill on Dix Hill at the age of 27. I went to Dix Hill the first time when I was 27 years of age. I never want to forget it as long as I live. I remember they took me in the admission building and put me in a ward. They called it the inebriate ward. They didn't know what it meant then, but it sounded pretty good. And as I said earlier, you know, you adjust to an environment. And the people around me in that ward, I was there for about 10 days, and they chase squirrels most of the time. And you do what they do. So I started chasing squirrels and got pretty good at it. Never caught one, come close. And then a few days later, they took me in another building, which was the old Edson building, as we call it. And that's when I began to have problems, physical problems. They put me down in what they call the skid row, which was a padded cell. They took my clothes away from me and let me have my running fits for days. And when I got through having my running fits, a few days later they let me out. That was the cure for alcoholism in 1956 in the state of North Carolina. Lock you up. I never want to forget. The first time I saw somebody else in DTs. Hell, I'd been through them. I didn't know I was that bad off, but I'd been through DTs before. I didn't know the man in the next cell. And when they took me out of there and gave me my clothes back, I was allowed to do the only thing I could do for the next 30-some-odd days. I would walk up and down the corridor day in and day out, wondering what in the hell I was doing there, because the men were a lot older than I. There were no young men there. And I didn't understand. But one night, a bunch of these fellows, grown men, were playing poker. They were using matchsticks for chips. And as they were playing cards, they began to discuss the reason they were there. One man spoke up and said, "I'm here because my wife wanted to get rid of me." And that kind of rung a bell with me. I thought Mama wanted to get rid of me. And my mother had done everything she knew to do for me prior to sending me to Digfield. That's the truth. Spent tons of money on me. But I heard one man speak up, and I can see his face tonight as it was 40-some years ago. And that man spoke up and says, "I'm here because I'm an alcoholic." First time I ever heard it, and kind of knew what it meant. And I began to think about my daddy, that, you know, compared my drinking with my father's drinking. And this was a game I was to play until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the truth is known, my father was a much better man than I ever hoped to be. And the problem I got into is drinking and where it led me. The day came I had to leave this place, and I didn't have anywhere to go. I'd lost everything I'd accumulated since I'd finished college. The cars, the bankroll, the house, the wife, the whole works. Everything I had lost. And what do? You go back home. And I went back to my hometown. My mother took me in, and the family doctor, ignorant of my situation, always worried about my nerves, decided he'd help me, and he gave me some tablets to take. Now, I don't know anything about drugs, but I do know something about tablets. And I took those tablets, and now you talking about being loose. I was real loose, and I was running around with the crowd I'd been in school with, and they were drinking every night, and I was taking my medicine. And I was usually in worse shape than they were. But one night, if I recall, it was about 9 months later. One night I decided I'd take a drink. And the theory that we have, you know, the compulsion that was talked about by Don, the compulsion set in. I took one drink and I had to have another. And what happened to me simply was I went back to the place that I was going to go again as long as I live, Dix Hill. And to make a long story short, I went back to Dix Hill 5 times in 6 months. 5 times in 6 months. Never understanding that I had a problem. Everybody told me I had a problem, but nobody told me what to do. I talked to a lot of doctors and a lot of physicians. A lot of ministers prayed over me, and a lot of friends tried to help, but nobody told me about Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. Nobody. The last time I went back to Dix Hill, I had tried drinking on top of antabuse. And if anybody here thinking about it, I can save you some time. If you don't want to die, it's a good way to end it all real quick, you know. And I went back. I drank antabuse on top of some wine when I was discharged. And what happened is I went back in the ambulance, and I wound up in the nut part of the bughouse instead of the drying out part. And there's the distinct difference. I found out what it was like to be tied down in the bed in a straitjacket. How you live better electrically, I found out about that too. I never want to forget that. And I began to accept my fate around these people in this war that I was over there with, a damn bunch of nuts, and that's what we were, that I'd probably stay there the rest of my life. Because nobody would have anything to do with me. We have a word you hear a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's the name of the vocabulary, coincidence. A coincidence happened. One day, by some strange reason, they took me out of that nut ward and put me back over there with the rest of the rummies in the old Edgerton building. Now, you got to understand something. I'd been there so much, they more or less made me an honorary attendant. I worked in the kitchen and go get mail and everything. And one day, going to get the mail, two other fellows and myself decided we'd leave. Escaped. It was like cops and robbers back then over there. And we got out of that place and jumped that fence that afternoon and wound up in downtown Raleigh that night. And the old Andrew Johnson Hotel, got a jug, and we're sitting there drinking. 6 o'clock news came on, and I made a bulletin that three criminal insane had just left Dix Hill. And we were sitting there watching this thing, and one of them said, "Wonder who the hell it is." And and they flashed pictures up there, you know, and my God, there we were. And one cried, and one started laughing, and one ran. I laughed, and one cried, started crying, and one ran like hell. We ain't seen him since. I don't know what happened to him. And so the other fellow and I, we decided that, hell, if we're gangsters, we better split up. And so he went his way, and I went my way, and I was on the streets in Raleigh the next morning, and a friend of the family that knew my mother saw me in there. He knew my background, knew what I was going through in life, put me on a bus and sent me back to Roanoke Rapids, down northeastern North Carolina, where I was raised. And unbeknownst to me, when I got home and broke into my mother's home, the right part of town and all that stuff, she had been in the hospital in Richmond with a nervous breakdown. And I didn't know it. And they brought her home a few days later and found me. I was drunk and laid up there in the bed and in my room. You know how we are. We have those rooms that we had when we were kids in my little room, and they found me. And that afternoon, they got together. Now, I don't know if you know who they are or not, but I'll tell you who they are. They, at that time, were my two sisters, the younger than me, and a friend of the family was like a father to me, and my mother. And they got, you know, they cracked the door, put you in one room, and they get in the other. And they talked just loud enough for you to hear them. And I heard them say, we're going to try to do something with him. We got to do something. And the end result was, one of them came in the room I was in and said, "We want you to leave this part of the country. You're killing mother." And I was. And, you know, when I saw the green, they really meant for me to, you know, they gave me a wad of money, and they really meant for me to leave. And I thought it was a good idea, too, when I saw that money. You know how we are. And so they bid me farewell that afternoon, and I left my home, where I was raised, to go to the West Coast, and I could have gone at that time with the role they gave me. And I went 4 miles to a neighboring town over in Weldon and pulled into the old Weldon Hotel, which was a railroad town at that time, and had a lot of friends there for a few months until the money ran out. And it ran out, and then the alcoholic always reverts back to what he'd always done outside of what I do. I'd go over town, and I bought an outboard motor. Didn't have a boat, but I bought a motor, and you know, I wrote a big check. Friend of the family in business, you probably knew it, man. I wrote a big check to pick up the motor later, and he gave me the change, and I went back to Weldon, and they called my mother to tell her that my motor was ready, and my mother took two and two together, and that afternoon, John Law was over there in that hotel, took me back to the city jail in Roanoke Rapids, where I was there for about a week or so. And I was in that drunk tank, and every night everybody left except me. Then one night I got to raising hell down there. I said, finally got the jailer down there. He said, "What's your problem?" I said, "I want to see my attorney." He said, "Who is your attorney?" I told him. He said, "Talk to him all you want to. He's next cell block." And sure enough, he was. And he couldn't do me any good that night. And this man later found Alcoholics Anonymous and became a member of the state legislature. He died sober. He couldn't do me any good. And what happened simply was a few days later, I had to be standing trial for something I didn't know I'd done on a previous drunk and a blackout in a courthouse. And then one day I was carried down a little bit further east. And to make a long story short, I've always been ashamed of it. I'm still ashamed of it. But if it took this for me to eventually get the Alcoholics Anonymous, I thank God for it. And I think it did for me, because I was one of these that had to be beat down to my knees before I could see myself. I was put on a chain gang down in the Great Dismal Swamp, working harder than I ever worked in my life. Now, prior to this, I'd heard about Alcoholics Anonymous one time. The time I heard about Alcoholics Anonymous was in Dix Hill. On Sundays, some fellows in Raleigh used to come over and put on a meeting. I was the joker to go to the meeting. You know, they'd say, "AA is here, everybody in the room," and we'd go in there, and I'd get in the back room, raise hell, make fun of them. Drank the coffee and ate the donut, but I'd make fun of them. I was about 5 years sober when I figured out they left every Sunday, and I had to stay. We're kind of slow, but that was the first time I heard about Dix Hill. The second time was in this in this prison camp because the fellow was a superintendent, was a young man, had a young wife, and they let me cut the grass at the house on Saturday afternoon. And they gave me a good meal on Saturday night. I got my smoking tobacco and soda pop by writing letters for these fellows. I was the only man there with an education. And you can imagine the little verbal abuse I took. But that was where I was. And this man talked to me one night, talking about, well, maybe I had a problem with booze and maybe I needed to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. No, I'm too young to be an alcoholic. And the day came I had to leave, I didn't know what to do. And they know what to do with you. They took me back to my hometown, put me out of city limits. I went back to my mother's home, and for the first time, nobody in the family had anything to do with me anymore. And I went to the back door this time. I don't know why, but I guess I was second class. And my mother let me in and began to talk to me and gave me some food, and they got together again. And they got in that room and started talking. And even my brother-in-law came over this time. And, well, I won't get on him. But anyway, the end result was I heard my mother say, "That's my boy, and he stays here tonight, whether you like it or not." And, you know, I look back, man, that's when I really believe that I said, I won't drink anymore just for her. And I don't recommend this before AA, after AA, trying to do it for somebody else. And, of course, the word sobriety wasn't in my vocabulary. My mother, at this time, clothed me and fed me just like when I was a kid. I got on my feet, and maybe it was suggested maybe I should go to work. Now, I didn't think I could get a job teaching the state of North Carolina. And so with an agency up in Richmond, I was interviewed in several states, three states, in a period of 1 week. My mother took me to these places. And I'd been out of 4 months. And one afternoon, on a Thursday afternoon, we went up in Roanoke, Virginia, and talking to a man superintendent of city schools in that city, and he offered me a job, assistant basketball coach and teaching mathematics, and he wanted some references. And he said, if you can give them to me, I can get on the phone, we can solve it while you're here, and I gave him a few names, And he left and went out of the room. I told my mother, I said, it's all over now. And he came back in 20 or 30 minutes, I guess, and said, I understand you had a problem with drinking at one time, but that you're cured now. And I didn't know what cured was. I hadn't drank anything in 4 months, doing fine, I thought. And I said, yes, I'm doing fine. We want you to go to work. Now, I had a new start in life in spite of the way I'd been and what had happened to me. And all through this, I had no knowledge that I had a problem with booze. That's the thing that I don't understand about alcoholism. Even today, the people that are going to come into AA, the people I've seen come into AA, and the people I work with, and that's the inability of the alcoholic to see himself as he really is in his worst moments. We cannot see ourselves as we really are. And I went back to my hometown. My mother bankrolled me, and I had a place to stay when I got back to Roanoke, and a nice home, and money in my pocket, and a job in spite of where I'd been. And on the way back to Roanoke on the Greyhound bus, I had a little layover and changing, and I decided I'd have one drink. But I bought two pints. And this is the drunk that got me to Alcoholics Anonymous, the only drunk that I really like to talk about. I got to Roanoke, and instead of going to the boarding house, I checked into a big hotel. And you know how we are. Did the same thing again. Started drinking and giving bad checks. I was able to work for 5 days, and the school authorities didn't know what had happened, and they helped me all they could, and it just got to be a big mess. Midway this drunk, the man who was sitting in school had talked to my mother and found out she wasn't going to help me. She got in touch with him midway this drunk. And my mother gave me the greatest gift she's ever given me since the day I was born. That's when she kicked me out of her life, and I knew she meant it. And she wished me luck, and a few days later, I was out of that hotel and wound up on the streets in Roanoke, Virginia, doing the best I could. Panhandling, On Sunday, September 11th, 1957, I was in back alley in downtown Roanoke, in what they call the market, trying to get a drink of liquor down, and my moment of truth finally came. For some reason that morning, I came to the conclusion that I was dying from what I was doing, that I was going to die in that back alley. And when I began to realize that what I was doing was killing me, I began to think I was a leper. I thought I was the only man on God's green earth like me. And I didn't know what to do. I did not know what to do. Maybe it was a coincidence. I just prayed out to God, somebody please help me. And the man that had hired me had been looking for me for several days. He didn't know anything about drunks. He didn't know anything about AA. He found me. He just wanted to help a human being. And he found me that Sunday afternoon in that back alley. Been looking for me for several days. And he carried me to his home that afternoon over in Southwest Roanoke and got in touch with another man that knew a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. And carried me to what was known then as the old Easy Does It Club, 12-step clubhouse in downtown Roanoke, where I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. I never want to forget it long. I mean, I got to the point my hair hurt, my toenails hurt, tired of the high cost of low living. I'd done anything. And I didn't have any, just straight ahead is all I could see. Jake Leggett, didn't know what was going to happen. And the principal and the superintendent carried me up to, I wasn't drunk, I was rum drunk. I couldn't find oblivion anymore. I couldn't black out anymore. And they carried me up those steps to the Easy Desert Club. And as I walked in, they began to look me over. We say we don't look them over. By God, you looked me over. Because what I had is what I had on. A paper bag that had a razor, a ear syringe, and a toothbrush, and 10 pennies. That's what I had in my name when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And they began to talk to these two gentlemen, and an old man was standing in the right-hand corner. He gave me this, and I wallowed to him, and he put his arm around my shoulders. I never forgot him. And I never forgot what that man told me. He said, son, said, I tell you what, said, all you got to do is listen to these people and do what they tell you to do, and you never have to be alone again. You never have to be alone again. And unbeknownst to me, what he was telling me was the first few lines of chapter 5, where it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who is thoroughly followed out the path. And this man that told me this, we called him Old Man John. He was a man that from up in New England was in the textile industry, lost everything he had, and his family kicked him out, and he wound up on the skids and run up. We called him Old Man John. Old Man John was 76 years of age when he come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he died at 82. I helped bury him, but he's the man that rang my bell, because he told me I didn't have to go out there anymore if I could do what you told me to do. I never want to forget it. And then I began to shake a little, and people told me, I said something about a drink, and they said, no, we don't do it that way. And then I said something about they told me to drink some coffee. I said, well, how about some, said something about some tablets, and I thought I'd start a revolution then. And drink the coffee. And I've always said, and this is no reflection on who makes coffee, but I've always said, and I still contend, that there are a hell of a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous making coffee that ain't got no business doing it. And that was one of those days. It was that ropey stuff. It just hung. And I thought it was a requirement. I really did. And so I drank the stuff. I got sick that afternoon from drinking the coffee. And they took me to my first meeting that night, the old central group in Roanoke. And I don't know what went on. I remember after the meeting, strangers are coming up to me, and that they gave me the magic words of Alcoholics Anonymous. We love you and we understand you're going to be all right. They didn't ask me where I came from, what I had, or anything. We love you and we understand you're going to be all right. And that night, three men got me a room at the YMCA, and I'll tell you how I got sober. I got sober by three men in Alcoholics Anonymous sitting down and talking to me all night long, telling me that I had a minute, I had an hour, I had several hours. And I'll never forget the man, the old Claude, he didn't go in there. I said, Dave, said, all we try to do is just do it a day at a time. First time I ever heard it. And I don't know, but somewhere in the dark recesses of my mind that morning, I really believed that I began to think that maybe I could. Maybe I could make it for a day. But thank God for some reason, I knew I had to be around them to do it. For some reason, I just knew I had to be around them to do it. And that's the way I feel about it this morning. I still got to be around you to do it. And later on, they carried me down to Dole Easy Does It Club, and I was introduced to a man who had become my first sponsor. I didn't ask for him. He appointed himself and asked me a lot of questions, and I didn't know how he knew all those things, but I gave him a few lies, and he said, "Stop lying. It's just lies. I know that." And asked me, would I do anything they asked me to do? And I told him I would. "Do you want sobriety more than anything else on God's green earth?" And I did. I told him, "Yes." "Are you willing to quit drinking forever?" By God, I knew what that meant. And I said, "I was." And he had 5 years sobriety at that time. And I began to trust a man in AA that morning. He had to go to the barber shop, and he wanted me to go with him, and he gave me a $10 bill. And he said, "Now, I'm going to the barber shop. You go over to that restaurant and see if you can get something down, get some eggs or something." And I've seen the sign, anybody give me a $10 bill, I've been long gone. And he trusted me enough, and I got me something to eat and went back to that barber shop, and he was through, and I handed him a change, and he said, "No, you keep it." Says, "Someday you'll have to do it for somebody else." And that was my first day in Alcoholics Anonymous. He got me a room in a boarding house where there were 5 other alcoholic men. None of them held a job. I didn't either. And I don't know where the money and the clothes came from my first few months of sobriety, but it came. And I began to get sober. Then I met my second wife, Sue, some of you knew, and she was a gift from God. And Sue had never seen me drunk, but she began to take interest in me, and I started dating her a little. And then I got a little sobriety, and it was an unusual group. There were some old-timers in it, and that time old-timers been 5 or 10 years. And they had a conference room in that group where they'd call you in and take inventory unannounced. They just sit down, "We want to talk to you." And they'd just take your damn inventory. And you had to do it. And if you didn't want it, they'd say, "You can get out. You can leave." That's the way it was. And they solved a lot of my problems. I didn't know it. Then one night, they had a meeting on my employment problem. And they got in there and started talking. And the man that solved my employment problem had a third grade education. He was a sign painter named Red. And he spoke up and said, "Dave, it seems to me that if you studied engineering in college, that's what you ought to be doing in life." Well, hell, nobody ever explained to me that way before. And so through Red's help and Sue's help, I was interviewed for a job over at Virginia Highway Department in Salem. And Ahab told me, said, "Tell the truth when you go in down there. Tell him the truth." And God, I told that man the truth, and he was just astounded. I mean, told him everything, you know. And I never forgot what he told me. He said, "Son, if you're willing to help yourself that much, we're willing to help you too. When can you go to work?" This was in December of just about 2 weeks before Christmas in 57. Now, I've been sober about 3.5 months. And I said, "Well, I tell you, I've got a lot of business to tend to. And be about 1st February." He said, "Well, that's all right. You come on back 1st February." I was scared to death. And I went on back out the car, and Red and Sue were in the car, and said, "How'd it go?" "Fine. Did you get the job?" "Yes." "When do you go to work?" I told them, hell, they carried me right back in there and went to work that afternoon. And I got a little sobriety there, and I began to know a lot in early sobriety. And that old group, I thank God for the people in the old central group in Roanoke. It was a good group. And they finally let me talk one night. The steering committee met on it. I'd been sober about 9 months. And what had happened, one of the fellows at the house had got drunk. And the other fellows brought him to the meeting and propped him up in the back. And somehow I just kind of thought, well, hell, I better talk to him. And I'll give a talk on how not to slip. Never heard of one being done, but I started one. And I'd been talking about 5 minutes. I heard somebody say, "Sit down." And when you start raving sober, you don't hear him. You know what I mean? And he said, sit down. I kept on going. And finally, he come to the podium and got me by the hand and took me down the aisle. My sponsor. I said, sit down. And as I was walking down the aisle, there, people's eyes are big, you know. Never seen anything like this in AA. And the thought crossed my mind, really and truly. This is my thoughts. My God, I got too much power for him. He don't want me to overdo it tonight. That's all it is. Oh, God. And I began to get in some problems, run around with the wrong people in an environment in sobriety that some people were telling me, just take the first step, that's all I needed. And I just about went out of the window with them, because one day they called me in that conference room. I'd been sober close to a year. Close to a year. A little over a year. And they had the old times. And they had been watching me. And they called me in and said, the bottom line was, Dave, you're going to get drunk. We want to tell you that you're going to get drunk unless you do certain things. And unless you get a hold of these steps and get honest with yourself. You got to work at this program. And God, it made me mad as hell. You know, I thought I was the backbone of the group at that time. And I was resentful, and I got mad, and I got ready to go out of that room. My sponsor stopped me and said, I want to ask you one question before you go. And the question was this: when was the last time you thanked God for a day of sobriety? And I left. I went back to that boarding house. And you know what I'm talking about when I tell you this. I want to do something to them. I didn't want to take a drink, but I want to twist something. I want to do something to them. So I sat down and I wrote a written resignation to Alcoholics Anonymous. By God, I let them know who I was. And as I was doing this composition, I began to hear my voice, the voice of my sponsor. It was an echo. When was the last time you thanked God for it? It got louder and louder and louder. And I was forced to my knees for the first time in my adult life and began to pray to a God I knew nothing about. God to me then was a question mark in the sky. Maybe yes, maybe no. And as a result of a juvenile prayer, I was able to walk into a bathroom and look at myself for the first time in my life, eyeball to eyeball, and know what I really was, that I was just a speck on this universe, and someday I'd die and soon be forgotten. And the only way I had to go was through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'd tried everything. And so the next night I went back and I rejoined Alcoholics Anonymous. And every year I get a chip, I rejoin. And I had to eat a little crow there for a day or two, but I became a member of the clique. I started doing what the other people did, working, sitting out the ashtray and cleaned up and doing what you had to do. And sobriety got good for me, and I got going in my work and promotions and everything. And then in 59, I moved to Raleigh, North Carolina, back to my home state, so I could get a divorce to marry Sue. And a man that was to become my second sponsor, had been recommended to me, was one of the early 100 members of Alcoholics Anonymous, a man named Tom Morrell, a native New Yorker. He lived in Atlanta for a while, and married a lady in Raleigh, and it was arranged for him to take me over when I got to North Carolina. And this man gave me much. He was the man that rammed the big book down my throat. When I moved to North Carolina, you know, I'd ask people questions, let them know how smart I was. And I'd ask Tom a question. He said, read the book. And he gave me a great lesson about standing behind one of these things. I'd been sober about 5 years, I guess, and been going to some of these conferences and retreats and everything. And I saw these jokers stand up here talking. Everybody clapped, hugged them, kissed them. And it kind of appealed to me. And so one night in the old Hayes Barton group, I told Tom, they had a conference room too. And I told Tom I needed to talk to him. So after the meeting, we got in the conference room. And he was one of these, made you sit down, he stood up and talked down at you. And kind of intimidated you a little. And he said, what's the problem? I said, Tom, I think I'm a convention speaker. Well, I can't repeat what he said from the podium, but I'll tell you this. The end of the conversation was this: from now on, you don't even speak at a meeting. You can go to discussion meetings. You don't tell your story. There was a moratorium put on my speaking for 2.5 years. And that's what I had to do. And my God, I said, and I did what he told me to do. And I'd been sober close. It was about 2.5 years later. He called me one day and said, come over to the house. I want to talk to you. And I went in that den. I sat down. He stood up. He said, listen. He had that long finger. You're going down to Columbia, South Carolina, to talk at the state convention. You do this. You do this. He told me all the things I had to do. And he said, something I want to tell you before I leave. He said, they asked me to go first. You're going as a damn substitute, and don't you ever forget it as long as you live. And so I feel like every time I get behind this podium that I'm just a substitute. And I never want to forget it because he gave me much. And then Tom died, and I got involved in service. I found out how to get a fellow that I'm sponsoring these. I own 38 years, and I'm his sponsor, and so we share a lot together. But sponsorship is a lot of it. And I've always said if anybody I work with get the half load, if they get half of what I got, they're going to make it because I got the whole load in that sponsorship. And I thank God for it. I don't know. There might be somebody here this morning that began to think like I did in early sobriety. Wonder if this thing really works. Is it for real? I know I kind of thought about it one time, but I really believe that the core and guts of this whole program is honesty. You got to be honest with yourself. It's based on truth. I heard a man say many years ago in Alcoholics Anonymous that when Jesus Christ walked the face of the earth in the body of a man, he didn't say, I'm a truthful man. He said, I'm the truth. I am the truth. I believe it's from this source and this root that we inherit the program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I've seen enough in my time and age not only to believe but to know that there is a power behind this universe that stands ready to help you and I if we're willing to help ourselves. Now, when I first got sober and began to see things, I called it the man upstairs. And this morning I called it the God of my understanding, the God that I found in these rooms with you people. God, the Father of all mankind. And he's never let me down. And all you got to do is ask him. He'll never let you down. My mother had a hard time accepting my sobriety and that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous after I got sober. It took about 9.5 years. She just couldn't believe, she couldn't understand how I could do this for a bunch of strangers and I couldn't do it for her. And I used to go visit her, and my sponsor couldn't intervene, and some people in my hometown, old J.T. and J.T. Cole, the old timer down there, and my wife, and nobody, she just wouldn't listen. But the day came, and it's another story, but she became later one of the greatest friends the Alcoholics Anonymous ever had. And then one of the grateful things that I'm very grateful that my mother lived me, see me sober 32 years before she died. And I'm grateful for that. My two sisters, they wouldn't let me into life for a long time. And now they're more than sisters. They're great. They love me, and we see each other quite often. And they think AA is for real. And one of them says, by God, she wants to become a drunk. So she because we have so much fun. And she's been to some of these. We got to a few of these retreats. And so things have turned around good for me. And then Julie came into my life. I've known her for several years at Blackstone. And we were married soon to be 2 years ago. And I've never had a family. Well, I got one now. I have a friend that Bill always said about kids, says you ought to be able to freeze dry them when they're 3 and thaw them out when they're 21. Well, I didn't have to worry about this. Julie's kids are on up in years, two of them in AA. And they're good kids. So I've got some benefits that I never knew I'd have through sobriety. I've been sober for a while, and I know there's still certain things I have to do. And the first thing I have to do is I have to continue to have a monumental desire to stay sober. You know, when I came to you, I told you I was willing to go in length to get this program. And that's the way I feel about it today. The second thing I have to do is I have to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's where it's at. That's where it's at. That's where you survive among individual egos, Alcoholics Anonymous. And the third thing I have to do is I have to try to work these 12 steps to the best of my ability, because that's the program as far as I'm concerned. And the fourth thing I have to do is I just have to remember that things are going to get better. That yesterday is my experience and tomorrow is my hope. And today is going from one to the other and doing the best I can. And as long as I can walk hand in hand with you down this happy road of destiny that we speak of in Alcoholics Anonymous, I too believe that I'll be allowed another day of sobriety. I believe it with all my heart. I've got to be around a lot of people in AA and friends, people to help me in. There's a couple that I used to sponsor, Vernon and Gertrude. Vernon and Gertrude, Vernon ought to have about 40 years sobriety, but he's going on 2. And Gertrude now has about 15. And early on in my sobriety, I worked with a man and wife, said never do it again. I've always said if you work with them, you would stay sober or get drunk. I come close to getting drunk, but they gave me so much. I remember one night years ago, Christmas Eve, and we had a meeting, and there were just a few people there, and they didn't have no driver's license. I had to go pick them up. And they got in the car, and we went to the meeting. It was on the 8th step. And after the meeting was over that Christmas Eve night, not about many people there, and we were going home, carrying them home. Gertrude says to Vernon, when are you going to make some amends to me? Now, they've been married 16 years at that time. When are you going to make some amends to me, honey? And I never forgot what Vernon said. He says, hell, Gertrude, you're not even on my list. Well, it's people like that I got to be around. And then there was another old fellow in my group, another in my group, but he rode with me, old Henry Honeycutt. Henry's dead now. Yeah, Henry sold me my first 2 cars. And this is alcoholic now. First car I ever bought from Henry was a Falcon. Hell, you couldn't even keep the thing in the road on me today. And I said I needed something bigger, so Henry sold me a Thunderbird. And old Henry was a great member of AA, and Henry would get drunk once in a while. And one day he got drunk, and a friend in AA, in the undertaking business, made arrangements. We got Henry over there and put him in a coffin over there at the funeral home. And Henry woke up and didn't know where the hell he was, and saw a man standing. It was old John who it was. And Henry says, where am I? And he says, hell, you're dead, Henry. And Henry said, how long have I been dead? He said, you've been dead 5 days. And he said, well, what are you doing here? He said, I'm dead too. And he said, how long you been dead? He said, I've been dead 9 days. Henry said, well, you ought to know where we can get a drink of liquor. That's a true story, by the way. It's people like that, but they gave me sobriety now. You know, coincidence. Is it a coincidence I'm here this morning behind this podium seeing people I've known throughout my life and sobriety? And like Liz said last night, over half my life has been an Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm tired of arguing with people about Alcoholics Anonymous. People that come in and want to argue about it. Or argue about the steps. I'm just tired of it. There's a lot of respect in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe what they told me when I come in here, just sit down and shut up and listen. And whatever you need to know, you'll find out. And listen to the people that have been here before you. And that's the way I found it, and that's the way everybody else ought to find it, I think. But I'll tell you this, is it a coincidence? I don't know. If it is a coincidence, I define a coincidence of act of God in the midst of time. The same God has been doing for you and I that which we could not do for ourselves. God the Father of all mankind. There's a few lines in my book that I could have said these lines when I started and sat down and have told my story and probably yours too. And I think it's very powerful. And I'd like to close with it because it means so much to me. And it goes something like this. This great experience that released me from the bondage of hatred and replaced it with love is just another affirmation of the truth I know. I get everything I need in Alcoholics Anonymous, and everything I need I get. And when I get what I need, I invariably find that it was just what I wanted all the time. Thank you very much.